So, as you think I figured out by now, I am doing the sermon as well as the service leader. So, this morning, as you know, we're talking about vibrations, as you see there. Vibrations are ubiquitous, from the tiniest subatomic particles to the vibration of black holes colliding. Sadly, we will not be talking about vibrations of black holes today. I'm going to throw out a few obvious examples, and then some maybe not so obvious.
Excuse me.
Your yard swing that your kid swings, or your porch swing, or, you know, we're all really familiar with those. The hula hoop is a form of vibration. Let me turn this thing off, because I keep getting feedback. And I think it's coming from this.
Oh, that's better. Okay.
The hula hoop is a form of vibration. Waves in the ocean or on a lake, water rings coming out from where something fell or was thrown into the water. Your windshield wipers, how about stirring liquid in a bowl? You stir slow and you go faster and faster, and all of a sudden it's slopping out of the bowl. Well, you found the resonance of that liquid in that bowl. Or the bathtub. How many of you remember when you were little, being in the bathtub and sliding back and forth in the tub, and the water's going with you and sloshing up the walls on either end, and you found you were playing with vibrations. You didn't even know it. Then there's clocks and watches. You know, clocks are obviously pendulums. Watches come later because for a watch, you obviously can't wear a pendulum. Every time you move it, throws it off. They use a torsional mass and spring, so it twists back and forth. And you've probably at some point all seen something like that. We're going to talk about a torsional system later on. Sound waves. I mean, we've been listening to music, and we're going to talk some more about music later on, but they're pretty ubiquitous. I don't think anybody's ever quite come up with a satisfactory answer that if a tree falls in the forest when there's nobody there, is it a sound? Actually, I think it's a language question rather than a physics question. Radio waves, same as light waves, electricity, etc. They're all electromagnetic waves, and the frequencies range from, I don't know how far down they can shoot. I don't know why they couldn't be super slow, and obviously they can be very fast in frequency, very high in frequency, I guess you should say. But, you know, light waves that we see with and the electromagnetic waves that our radio signals come from, and X-rays and, you know, cosmic rays, these are all different frequencies electromagnetic waves. Hurricanes and tornadoes are a form of atmospheric disturbance that is vibrational in some ways. And, of course, those vibrations create smaller vibrations, waves of sea waves and all kinds of things. Oh, you know, one I hadn't thought of. Earthquakes is also, it starts off with a force, but then the vibrations are sent through the rock in three different forms, which we will not get into that either today. How many of you are familiar with Foucault's pendulum? It's a Foucault's print pendulum. There used to be one in the State Museum when it was over what was formerly a federal building. And I don't know if they moved it to the new Indiana State Museum or not.
Yeah.
Did they? It's a pendulum that runs in two modes. So where it's attached, it can move in any direction. And it swings back and forth like you'd expect of a pendulum to do, but it also rotates the direction it swings as the earth turns. So it shows directly shows the rotation of the earth. And it varies at the North Pole. It completes the circle in 24 hours. And at the equator, it doesn't do anything. And in between, it varies in length of time depending on the latitude you're at. And we won't get into the physics of that either. That's going to be a refrain maybe today. where am I at here? Oh, yeah, Foucault's pendulum. Christian Huggins, I probably pronounced that wrong, in 1665, in a letter to his father, he reported his observation that two identical clocks hung on a beam of the house synchronized to each other after about 30 minutes. The motion of the two pendulums was such that their periods were identical, but their displacements were opposite in direction. So, whoop, come back here. So this, they were swinging like this, not like this. This is opposite. Synchronous pendulums are described mathematically using nonlinear systems equations, which means that you don't want to try to figure out why they behave that way. A friend of mine who I worked with many, many years ago at Switzer, we worked on crankshaft torsional vibration dampers, which is where, one of the places I got my interest. So when the piston fires and pushes on the crank of the piston, for those of you who aren't at all familiar with automotive, it works like a bicycle, except instead of your feet driving the pedals, the pistons drive the pedals. And every time a piston fires, there's a big mass on the end of the crankshaft, the flywheel, and every time a piston fires, it bends that crank a little bit in a twisting way. And then if you've got an 8-cylinder engine, that's happening 4 times every revolution. What's a 4-cycle? Yeah, 4 times every revolution from that. And there's also an opposite direction twist from the pressure cycle, where it's compressing the gas. So that I was just astounded at how complicated the vibrations of this system. We modeled it on a computer using, I think it was 8 or 10 masses and springs, which was a gross oversimplification, but was adequate for what we wanted to do. But that's one of the things that got me really interested in vibrations, because you look at, I tried to find a good waterfall display, which is a three-dimensional plot that shows how complicated all this is, but I couldn't find one that seemed to be really good. And then I would have had to explain it, so that's another problem. So at any rate, Bob, a little off track there, but Bob made this frame about 2 feet wide, 2 feet tall. He custom wound a spring, a helical or spheric, what's the other word, spiral spring, and he hung this disc on the bottom of it. And he intentionally designed it so the linear inertia and the rotational inertia and the spring, that it ended up that the bouncing frequency was close to the twisting frequency. So you take this mass and you pull it down, you let go of it, and it starts bouncing. And it starts bouncing, and then slowly it starts twisting, and twisting more and more, and bouncing less and less, until finally it's just twisting. And then it slowly it starts twisting less and less, and bouncing more and more, until it's just bouncing. And it goes back and forth between twisting and bouncing. And people look at it and go, how do you make it do that? Well, it's actually, in physics, it's a pretty straightforward thing. It's a 2-degree-of-freedom coupled system. The 2-degree-of-freedoms are the bouncing and the twisting, and the coupling comes from the spring, because when a helical spring is stretched, it wants to twist a little. Or if you twist it a little, it wants to draw up or draw down a little. So every time it bounces, it gives a little kick to the twisting motion. And every time it twists, it gives a little kick back to the bouncing motion. So, and interestingly, a 2-degree-of-freedom system always has 3 frequencies. Well, obviously one's the bouncing and one's the twisting. The third is the rate at which it goes from bouncing to twisting and back to bouncing. So, but the interesting part, this passing energy between different modes of location is called entrainment. And you see it everywhere, and we'll talk a lot more about that as we go on. I lost my place. Oh, there I am. So, let's see if I can pick up this. I have a video, very quick video. If it comes up right here, there it is. Hey, Matt, sorry. There. Okay, so this is the primary mode of that string bouncing. The base frequency. And now that's the second mode. And that's twice the frequency of the first. This is basic string vibration. And now they've gone to the third mode. And so that's the third frequency, and it's twice the previous frequency. And that's all we're going to talk about that, but we're going to come talk, that's all we're going to get out of that. Who's talking and why? Anyway. YouTube drives me nuts. Let me get the other screen back up. There we go. Those modes, a string's a very simple system because it's all linear. Everything about it mathematically is linear, which is why you only get the basic, you don't get any overtones or undertones. You don't get anything that's not a direct square multiple of the first mode. If you have something, some of you have probably seen the videos of a plate and they mount it on something that makes it vibrate. And you see all these different shapes, put sand on it so you can see where the node lines are. And they make all these, well, it's a very complex shape vibrationally. So it has lots of different modes and lots of different frequencies that aren't just multiples of the previous frequencies. So that's to give you a start here. Now, Sam gave me permission to come over. And I'm just going to talk loud and not mess with this thing. Oh, hello. So I should turn the sound off on my phone, too. Give me just a second here, or we'll probably get a phone call in a minute. Oh, okay. Good idea. Too much to do. There we go. So I'm going to pluck an E string here. This is the E above middle C, which is the, well, if you're looking at the guitar when you're playing it, it's on the bottom, but it's considered string number one. So you see all those frequencies. And like I was talking about with the other one, every one is a doubling of the one below. And the reason they look so spread out is because it's a logarithmic scale. So, hertz is here, 1,000 hertz is here, and 10,000 hertz is over here. So that's a logarithmic scale, and we could spend the whole 20 minutes talking about logarithmic scales. But it's graduated because it makes more sense to look at sound frequency or any kind of a vibrational system that doubles like sound in that way. But if we do that again, frequencies on the right look smaller than the ones on the left because the scale is increasing so fast. They're actually, each one is a doubling of the one before. And I'm going to play an E chord here.
Not sure the mic is on.
So I'm going to play an E chord here. There's a lot more peaks in there for the E chord. But that's because there's six strings vibrating. So the six strings vibrating, each string has a different progression of frequencies, and so you get a lot more peaks. So those vibrations in all the strings, each string affects how the other string sounds because the waves overlap in a way that they reinforce each other, and that adds to the tonality of the instrument. And it's exactly the same at a different scale as the two clocks on the beam. It's passing, the two clocks are passing energy through the beam to synchronize. The guitar is passing energy between the strings to reinforce each other through the bridge at the bottom and the nut at the top. Mostly through the bridge at the bottom, which is on the body that resonates a lot. So I'll give you, let's do this first. So if I sing, I go, how do you say, well, there's all kinds of odd things there because there's multiple voice box is not a linear system like a string. So it has a variety of frequencies in it. And then there's my vocal tract, which has a variety of resonances in it. So things will change depending on as far as how it resonates and everything else as my pitch I sings. So, I mean, you can't really figure out what's going on there because it gets pretty complicated, but the voice is a very complicated and a pretty neat instrument. So we'll talk a little bit more about entrainment. Turn this mic off. An example of entrainment is a singer singing a note to break a wine glass. If you were going to do that, you would tap the wine glass to get the natural frequency of it, and that's the frequency you sing at. And as you move up in frequency by something that resonates, as you cross that frequency, it will go up like this and come back down. So the frequency of the driving force, which is her voice in this case, and the frequency of the glass is what makes that drive so much that it can break the glass. So there's a thing I read, I think it was in a book, about a park that was being reworked because it was very little used, and they brought some audio people, I think maybe they volunteered to come in, and they put, I don't remember, 4 or 5 pipes in the park, and they were cut the lengths to match certain notes on the scale, probably something like a major 7 chord. And they put mics in each pipe, and they ran that to an amplifier and put speakers around. So if a bus was coming to a stop and the brakes kind of squealed, that mic come through the mic and across the frequency that matched the frequency of the pipe. When the bus starts off and the engine goes, well, every time that noise passes one of the frequencies of one of the pipe will resonate, increase the volume, and it'll come out through the loudspeakers. So essentially they were taking the noises, and it was a noisy area, was one of the reasons they had not used the park very much. But it made the noise in the area to sound like music. It was really a cool idea. And one of the other interesting things about entrainment is passing energy, like I said before. If you look at information theory about how information is interchanged, the base definition of information theory is, sharing energy between two systems. If you haven't got that, you don't have anything. So let's talk about music a little bit. So, you know, most musical compositions end on a major chord, and they say that's a resolution. So one of my favorite songs is Manhattan Transfer singing Berkeley Square. Go all the way through the piece with no major chord. And it wraps around and it just does all kinds of wild things. It's really cool to listen to and pay attention to the chords. And at the very end, it resolves with a major chord. But what is it about a major chord that makes it a resolution? And I don't know if any of you ever thought about this at all before. It's kind of like, why is music music? Which is way more than we can get into here. That would probably be an hour session with somebody just to scratch the surface. But what happens with a major chord is that the frequencies are most in tune. They have the most overlap with the peaks between the three notes in a major chord of any chord you can come up with. Now, if you're playing a C chord, which is C, E, G, and you move the E down a step, it becomes E flat. And that is not nearly as in sync. And that's why it sounds sad. Now, Julian and I were talking about this on the way here, and he knows a lot more music theory than I do. But he said that it's because our culture has taught us that a major chord sounds like a completion, and that a minor chord feels sad. Although I think you could say that the major chord, the minor chord has more dissonance than the major chord, put it that way. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. I didn't mean to say that. So this whole question of why do we have the notes? The Indian music has a lot more notes than our system does. We
which is why it sounds so different. But those questions.
Can you clarify which Indian is Easter or American?
India music. I think Native American music may be not a little bit simpler, because flutes have a full scale, same as where ours does, I think. I know they do now, I don't know that they did in the past. Let me turn the page here. So then another thing about music, why do angry young people like hard rock and metal and rap? Well, I would say that it's because it's more cacophony, it tends toward the atonal, not harmonic. It sounds like turning things down. So, you know, if you're an angry young person, then that's appealing. And when we finally get somebody in here to play our organ again, pay attention not just to how it sounds, but how it feels. Because especially with the energy coming from organ pipes, you will feel the vibrations in your body in different places depending on what the note is. Because it depends on what parts of your body are close to that resonance that get excited by the sound. And there is, I meant to look her name up, but I didn't. But if you go to TED and Google deaf percussionist, you'll find this woman who is from Scotland, I think, who is a deaf percussionist. And she has a TED talk, and then there's a couple films. It's really fascinating stuff. They tried to not let her into the music school. She fought it and got in, and changed for their criteria for how they let you into school. So, okay, I need to get moving here because we're going to run out of time. I want to talk about nature a little bit. First, let me say vibrations are complex. We think of vibrations kind of in our hearing range or maybe higher and lower because of the electronic stuff we know of. But, you know, in reality, a cycle might take a vibration might take a day or a week or a month. A good example are tides in the moon. Tides cycle through, depending on where you are, too, but they cycle through in a little under a day, I believe, generally. Jerry Padgett, who lived out in this area and was a member of Circle Fellowship, who's also the head of the State Parks in Indiana, I know Sam really. He took us to Brown County to see their deer explosion. How many of you have heard of a deer explosion? Sam's heard of a deer explosion. So we get to the park, we walk about 150 yards downhill to this deer enclosure, and we're walking through this forest that has fruit mature trees and grass on the ground. And we get to the deer enclosure, and I would guess it was maybe 60, 70 feet long, maybe 30 feet across. It must have been 15 feet high to keep the deer up, because they can really jump. It is so thick with plants in there that you can't see 3 feet into it. That is all the stuff that is not growing in the forest floor because the deer are eating it all. And this was when they were fighting with the public about shooting deer in Brown County State Park. And this was one of the things that helped them justify it because, you know, and the deer everywhere are a problem, especially around farms because they see so much of the crops. So that's one example of a runaway cycle. There's no predators for the deer, so they just keep eating crops and eating everything and fine, and just keep the population just increases. Another example that clarifies how to fix that is the Yellowstone Park, where the valleys were getting, like the forest floor was, where we went, because they had killed the cotton with all the wolves, and there was nothing to stop the elk from just multiplying and multiplying. And they introduced wolves back into the park. And over a period of years, the wolves encouraged the elk to go to higher ground because they were pretty easy to get in the valleys. And then the trees and the brush and everything else came back. The fish increased, the beavers came back because they had trees to use. And it's been a massive recovery. Now, if we could let wolves back in this area, nobody's going to buy into that. Yeah, because I don't think coyotes are able to take down wolves, but we certainly have the coyotes coming back. But that's another cycle, and these happen all the time. The coyotes eat the rabbits, coyotes multiply and then the rabbit population falls off and the coyotes die back and the rabbit comes back and the coyote, and it's, so it's a cycle.
You put Chula Rima in there too.
I'm sorry?
You need to put Chula Rima in there too. That's a three-way cycle.
Oh, well, usually this isn't a two-way cycle. Usually this is a cycle that not only includes the animals involved, but you know, when the rabbits die back, it changes the vegetation. So, and if you've got other animals involved, and so it gets really complicated. It's an ecosystem. If you change one thing, it changes everything. But it's all a complex vibrational system, too. If you look at it, it's one way to model it. You know, science does not give you reality. Science gives you models. That's a whole other sermon. Robin Wall Kimmerer, who's a botanist and author of one of my favorite books, Braiding Sweetgrass, says that all nature is interconnected, and the more biologists look, the more they see the interconnections. And as much as we seem to want to hide from it, we are part of nature. My mother-in-law worked in microbiology before she retired. When I asked her about vibration and biology, microbiology, she told me that the complex shapes of proteins fold into, and the folds determine what other proteins of given protein will bind with. They think the binding involves vibrations, and in fact, it appears that most, if not all, of the processes in the body involve vibrations for making them work. And if you think about, how many of you meditate? A couple, three people. When you lay really still, you can feel your heartbeat. And if you feel in your body when you feel your heartbeat, you realize there's a pressure wave that moves through your body when your heart beats. And I mean, it makes sense. This heart's beating, the arteries are, it may be harder to feel if you are really old and your veins and arteries are really stiff. But anyway, you can feel this pressure move through your arteries. And so that pressure wave, we know that in chemistry, changing the pressure affects reaction rates. So if the pressure changes, that's affecting how the reactions occur and how often they occur and all kinds of things. I mean, it's just like the crankshaft, it gets really complicated. But that pressure wave is having an effect on how our body behaves. Something else to try if you haven't, I already said that. Okay, and last but not least, I want to do a short visit with quantum mechanics. Electron shell. Sorry? Good luck.
Short visit?
Well, I'm going to touch on it. I'm not really going to explain it. Electron shells and atom are defined vibrational principles. They sit at levels the shells of electron can move in, sit at levels that make sense in terms of vibration, what's stable in vibration. It's kind of like the moon. The reason the moon faces the Earth is because it's in a gravitational relationship. And over who knows how many million years that forced the moon into an orbit that's stable, always facing the Earth. So anyway, electron shells are based on vibrations. Concept of atoms came from Democritus around 400 BC, which is just everything's made of little, very, very tiny particles. Basic concept wasn't refined until the early 1800s. In the late 1800s, scientists found themselves in a dilemma. Some experiments said that electrons had to be particles, could not possibly be waves. Another experiment said that electrons had to be waves, couldn't possibly be particles. And like we were talking about before, the waves we're talking about are electromagnetic waves. Worse than that, the efforts to resolve the issue led to the realization that there is no such thing as an elementary particle. When particles become very small, they stop being either particles or waves, and they simply become probabilities. What they become is not independent of the observer. I say that right? What they become is not. I think I got that backwards. It's not dependent on the observer, is what that should say. What they become is not dependent on. No, it is. I told you I didn't sleep last night. What they become is dependent, that's right, and not independent of the observer. I shouldn't have made it a double negative. So it's affected by what the observer does, but the basis of science is that the scientist is an independent observer separate from the test that they're performing, the experiment they're performing. All science is based on this independent observer. Some physicists have called this the end of science. Our reality still behaves according to Newton's laws, but only because wavicles, which is what some particles, some physicists call these strangely acting things that seem to be some common interpretation of both particles and waves. And mass quantities behave according to Newton's laws, but of course ignoring Einstein's general theory of relativity to say that. Because things get weird when things get very small, and they get weird when they get very large. So we seem to be living in between, a kind of a liminal space. But throughout it all, vibrations connect everything together in a wholeness, a oneness that can't be denied. The whole point of this presentation has been to help you realize that when I say vibrations are ubiquitous, are everywhere, I am not exaggerating. In fact, I'm probably minimizing. Just sitting down in the breakfast club this morning with us talking, I came with three more examples of vibration. One of them is walking. You know, when you walk, there's a vibrational component to it. When you run, there's a different vibrational component. And there were a couple others, I don't remember what they were now. I haven't even addressed, you know, that brain waves of a talented professor and his students will synchronize during a lecture. I wanted to show you a waterfall plot of the crankshaft I talked about earlier, which is three-dimensional, of the twisting vibrations in a crankshaft, just because the vibrations are so complex. But I decided it was too difficult to explain what it showed because of the complexity. When we look at the presence of vibrations everywhere and entrainment between anything in any way connected to anything else, I hope it becomes obvious that everything is connected to everything else in one vast network of vibration. In fact, literally in fact, the ubiquitous interconnected vibrations are telling us that Shiva, in the Hindu religion, who is the universe, and he, the universe, is dancing. That Shiva is not a metaphor, but is in fact the reality of the